Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Today, our program is Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In John Perkins' third edition of his New York Times best-selling book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John reveals the wave infecting the world, and at the peak of the devastation sits China with its modified version of the U.S. economic hitman strategy. This new model has proven even more dangerous and successful. John exposes corruption on an international scale. However, all is not lost because John provides a source of hope for transforming the death economy into a life economy and inspires readers to participate in the new era of global cooperation. We have big things to do. Our guest today is that very John Perkins. John is a former chief economist who advised the World Bank, the United Nations, Fortune 500 corporations, and governments around the world. Now, John is a sought-after speaker and author of 11 books that have been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 70 weeks, has sold over 2 million copies, and are translated in more than 35 languages. In his latest book, the third edition of his New York Times bestseller, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, China's Economic Hitman Strategy, Ways to Stop the Global Takeover, John continues his revelations on a corporate system that cheats and strong-arms countries out of trillions of dollars. John, it is such an honor. Thank you for being our guest today. Welcome to Be Bold America.
Thank you so much, Jill. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
Oh, it is my honor. I'm just so excited. And before we even get started, you write early in your book that you had lunch with Howard Zinn, and he was a professor, and Howard Zinn is a hero of mine. So can you just briefly tell me your experience with Howard, who he was, just briefly?
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, Howard's a hero of mine, too.
Oh, good.
And,
yeah.
You know, and I was in business school at Boston University when he was teaching political science there, and I took a couple of elective courses from him. They were huge lecture courses, so, yeah, 400 people or so. I don't remember the numbers, but I was up in the balcony always looking down on this firebrand of, you know, and at the time it was the Vietnam War that he was, you know, opposing. And he had a huge influence on me, and I never got to meet him personally. You know, the classes I went to were smaller than the lecture were taught by graduate students. But after Confessions came out, he and I connected, and we had many lunches and a couple of dinners together whenever I was in the Boston area. He lived in Newton and you know, hung out in Cambridge, Harvard Square a lot. So we'd meet and have lunch he was extremely enthusiastic about what I was doing. It's funny because his first reaction, he told me, so he read the book one time, after I finished it, I slammed it down on my desk and I said, "Damn it all, you know, didn't this guy learn anything from me? He went to work as an economic hitman." And then he said, "You know, I enjoyed reading the book because it reads like a novel, even though it's all factual." And he said, that summary, read it again. And afterwards, I put it down more gently, and I said, "Well, thank God he didn't listen to me and became an economic hitman, and now he can write about it from the inside." So we had some wonderful conversations.
Oh, he's just such a hero, and I'm sorry he's not with us today, but he'd probably be pulling his hair out. Anyway, John, there's so much in your intense and brilliant book to talk about. I think the best place to start would be defining who an economic hitman is, his or her role is. And you also mentioned jackals. So who are economic hitmen and jackals?
Well, yes, Jill, thanks. So earlier you mentioned that I was chief economist at this consulting firm. I had as many as 50 people working for me. That was my official title. But we kind of tongue-in-cheek called ourselves economic hitmen, at least a few of us did. And our job, my job, was to identify countries that have resources that our corporations want, like oil in those days and still, and then to arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money did never actually go to the country. the country signed off on the debt, had to put up its resource, oil, and today it might be cobalt or lithium, one of those minerals that are so necessary for the green economy, but put that up as collateral. But they didn't get the money. The money actually went back to our corporations, U.S. corporations, to build big infrastructure projects in that country. And so our corporations made big projects. They built electric power systems, highways, ports, airports, industrial parks, things like that that benefited a few wealthy families, and, of course, our own corporations, but really hurt everybody else. So the wealthy families benefited because they own the industries that use a lot of electricity, use the highways and the ports. But everybody else had to contribute to paying the interest on the debt. And so money was diverted from health care, education, and other social services to pay the interest. And in the end, the principal couldn't be repaid, usually. So we'd go back, usually in the guise of the IMF, and say, hey, since you can't pay your debt, sell your oil or whatever the resource is real cheap to our corporations without environmental or social regulations, or allow us to build a military base on your soil, or vote with us at the next United Nations vote against Cuba or some such thing, and privatize your public sector businesses like your water and sewage systems and sell them to our investors at cut rate prices. So we were really creating this corporate empire, Jill. And you mentioned the jackals. Well, these leaders, my job was fairly easy to sell this, even though these leaders knew that they were screwing their own people. And it was easy to sell partly because they knew that their families and their cronies who owned the industries would gain from this. But also they knew that behind me stood the jackals. If they didn't agree to these deals, people that are CIA assets that would overthrow governments or assassinate leaders. And unfortunately, the United States has a very long history of doing this in places like Chile with Allende and Arbenz in Guatemala and Lumumba in the Congo and on and on and on. The list is very extensive.
Wow. Well, as you also talked about the U.S. Also justified, you know, the subjugation of others in order to advance, you know, the pursuit of wealth and power. How did that fit into this?
Well, you know, the U.S. is, you know, people don't like this word, but we really, my job was to create an empire. And in some respects, it's more a corporate empire than a U.S. or American empire. The U.S. government supports it, but these corporations don't necessarily support the U.S. They don't pay taxes, many of them. So it's this corporate empire. And empires throughout history have always used highfalutin ideas to promote and justify what they do. And in our case, you know, we were justifying that we were spreading democracy around the world. We were spreading capitalism. We were fighting the Soviet Union and China and communism. And of course, a lot of that wasn't at all true. We supported brutal dictators in countries if those brutal dictators helped our corporations. And we also arranged to overthrow democratically elected presidents like Mossadegh in Iran and Allende in Cuba, and more recently in 2009, Zelaya in Honduras. So, you know, what we said was very misleading, but our claim was that we were doing all of this to promote democracy and capitalism and oppose communism.
Well, you wrote, too, that success is measured by short-term profits, stock prices, and trade balances, and that were integral to the propaganda machine politicians and corporate leaders wanted people to think about that, you know, in the corporatocracy. And it reminded me of Naomi Oreskes' book, The Big Myth. And she was talking about the myth of the free market and that the free market is outside of society, you know, that can't be questioned. It's godlike, and you have to trust it like a religion. And she called it market fundamentalism, and that really corporations got us to believe the free market was separate from society and to trust it religiously. And that, say, ExxonMobil's interests are really also our interests, but that the corporate propaganda has really devastated impacts on addressing a lot of issues in the country. So how do you see the work you did in support in relation to the quote-unquote the free market?
Well, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there. The term free market is a propaganda term. There's nothing free about so many of the markets that we're involved in. Without getting into a lot of detail, for example, that we have these trade relationships with free trade relationships with Central America called CAFTA, and North America and Mexico and Canada and the United States called NAFTA. And these are very, very much in favor of big corporations. They hurt small farmers. They hurt small businesses. If people are interested in going in more detail, I just recently wrote a newsletter about that. It's on my website, johnperkins.org. But suffice it to say that we promote all of this as a free market. It's not free at all. It's very complex and very biased toward corporations. And yeah, this whole system is based on the goal of maximizing short-term profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. And that really came into being in a strong way in 1976 when Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize in Economics and very much promoted this idea. It had been growing before then, but when I was in business school before that, we were taught that, a corporation should make decent rate of return for its investors, but also help its employees, give them health care and retirement pensions, and take good care of the communities where it works by investing in recreational facilities, et cetera. So that all changed in 76 when Friedman said the only responsibility is to maximize short-term profits. And that changed everything. Friedman had a very strong influence around the world, and including with Thatcher and Reagan. And so what we've really created with this aspect is what economists are increasingly referring to as the death economy. And this is an economic system that's created climate change, income inequality, species extinctions, terrible environmental destruction. It ravages in the short term the resources it needs for the long term. It's killing itself, and it's killing the rest of the planet, life on the planet, with pollution and overconsumption. And so that's a system that really, my job was to create this system. I didn't see it that way at the beginning. I thought I was doing the right thing, but we can get into that more if you want about the way we measure the system and how deceptive it is. But that's what we were doing, was creating this death economy, an economic system that's failing us.
Well, we will get into that after the break. I did want to share with you that my last guest, Dr. Warren Hearn, he wrote a book called Homo Oecophagus. And he didn't believe that Homo sapiens, wise man, that means, was really very wise. He now calls our species Homo Oecophagus, man who devours the ecosystem.
I love that.
Isn't that great? So time for a break.
We actually call ourselves Homo sapiens. Sapiens.
Right.
The wisest of the wise.
That's right. And we're just, 180 degrees opposite, it seems. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and our guest is John Perkins. And we are discussing the third edition of his New York Times bestselling book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, that updates his original book with China's dangerous and successful hitman strategy. See a video John has for you at johnperkins.org/economic-hitman-book. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Tom Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
We're back. Would you like a friend to hear this interview on Confessions of an Economic Hitman? Well, tell them that this interview and many other Be Bold America interviews are available as a podcast. They may subscribe for free from their favorite podcast platforms such as Apple, Google, Spotify, and Radio Public. Now, John, I did want to talk about right away here, what are China's economic hitmen more dangerous and successful? Why are they more dangerous and successful? What's going on?
Well, Jill, I taught at an MBA program in Shanghai in China a few years back, and it was fascinating to me that the students were, many of them had been out in the, in fact, I think all of them were required to have been out in the workaday world as executives, and these were very, very intelligent and very well-trained Chinese students, people who had been identified as the future leaders of China. They were all members of the Communist Party, and I very quickly understood that one of the reasons they'd invited me to speak there was because they wanted to learn what I thought even we economic hitmen, what mistakes we'd made, and also what successes. And they wanted to learn this because they wanted to get better than us.
Oh, boy.
And in fact, they have. You know, today, it's not a question of, people say, well, what if China takes over the world? Well, China has taken over the world. It is the number one trading partner with almost 130 countries versus our 50 some odd countries. It's almost triple us, and that's all happened since about the year 2010, 2012, when Xi came into power, President Xi. Mm-hmm. They've done a magnificent job. If you want to call it a magnificent job, they've done a much more efficient job than we ever did at convincing much of the world to buy into their sphere of influence and become their trading partners. And they are also the number one investor in most of these countries on every single continent.
Wow, to say China has taken over the world is a big statement.
Well, it has. You know, even in the United States, they're a number three trading partner. We're very, very dependent on China. China's also dependent on us. There's an interdependency there for markets and for many of the things that we produce. So, as I think probably most of your listeners know, China controls a huge percentage, about, I think, 90% of the world's lithium and a huge amount of cobalt and many of the rare metals that are needed for the green economy, for lithium batteries and other microchips. They have a tremendous control over these things. And I have to say that the United States, we have really blown it in the last, I guess you could say, two, three decades. I think it really started with 9/11. And after that, we devoted so many resources to Iraq and Afghanistan that we kind of forgot about Latin America and Africa and much of the rest of the Middle East and Asia. And China didn't get involved in that, in the Middle East very much. They didn't get involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they really moved into these other countries. They saw a tremendous opportunity, a vacuum left by us. And in the process of what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, we scared a lot of the rest of the world. We there's a lot of resentment around the world to us about the United States. And I hate saying that. I'm a very strong patriot. My ancestors fought in the American Revolution. But I also know that the only way to get better is to understand the mistakes you've made and change them. And so I see part of my job as being to identify the mistakes that we here in the United States have made so that we can correct them and get better and be true competitors on the world stage in the way that we used to be.
Well, you also talk about the characteristics of a death economy and how to transform to a life economy. Can you explain more on that?
Yes, well, so I think I've said that, death economy is based on the idea of maximizing short-term profits regardless of the social and environmental costs, and it's caused most of the crises that we're facing today, the global crises like climate change and environmental destruction. The life economy is based on a goal of maximizing long-term benefits for people and nature. And amongst corporations, and a lot of corporations are moving into this. I talked to a lot of the executives who see this as a real opportunity, that you have to make short-term profits to stay in business, but you don't have to make, you don't have to maximize those profits. You don't have to get windfall profits at the expense of the long term. So a lot of the smarter corporations today are increasingly moving toward, looking toward the long term as well as the short term. And they understand that in the life economy, you pay people to clean up pollution, you know, to mine all the plastics in the ocean, to regenerate, to rejuvenate destroyed environments, plant forests where forests have been destroyed, revitalize the coral reefs. You pay people to get involved more in things that recycle and in technologies and processes that, that don't ravage the earth. That you know, we've been doing this with solar and wind power, but I think most of us would realize that we've just broken the surface there. You know, there's so much more that we can do in the field of energy, in the field of transportation. We've been moving more and more to electric cars. There's so much more we can do. And people object to us sometimes. They say, well, electric cars, you know, they use lithium batteries. And that's all true, but we're in a transition phase here where we really need to keep moving in new directions. And I have to say that China's working very hard to out-compete us in this regard, too.
Well, earlier you mentioned how the U.S. has really blown it, and you thought, since 9/11, and one of my previous guests was Dr. Brian Welch, who's a psychiatrist and lawyer, and he doesn't think we ever recovered from 9/11. He still thinks we're dealing with that today. And you also talked about, you know, we've got to know what our mistakes were to be able to correct them and to do this. Can you expand on that some more? What mistakes do we need to correct?
Well, yeah, so there's two parts of that question. I think there's, I don't think we've recovered from 9/11 either. We're kind of stuck in this idea that the world is out to get us, that we somehow have to maintain a huge military. You know, it was the one thing that wasn't up for grabs in the recent budget negotiations, or debt ceiling negotiations. And yet it's bigger than the next 10 biggest militaries combined. it's there's a lot of fat in there.
Yes.
What was the second part of the question? Your question?
The other part was, you know, you talked about we made a lot of mistakes in these past decades. And what were some of them?
Well, for example, the wars that we conducted in Iraq and Afghanistan and the very strong anti-Muslim attitudes that evolved with that have had a huge impact in the Muslim world. And just today, Saudi Arabia announced that it was going to decrease its production of oil, so the price of oil will go up, and that'll help Russia, of course. And Saudi Arabia used to be an extremely loyal ally of ours. I write in my book about the deal I struck with the Saudis back in the 70s, which was a very important one. But they've changed now, partly because they don't like the anti-Muslim, what they see as an anti-Islamic philosophy in this country or bias. And they're siding more and more with China. So the other mistakes, I mean, we've made mistakes by building military bases on way over 100 countries. And nobody wants a military base on their soil, except maybe a few of the leaders who use it to keep their people down or threaten their people. But, you know, during the American Revolution, one of the things that caused that was that all the military personnel that the British had here, which we deeply resented. Nobody wants that. We've been doing that. China has not done that except on a very limited basis. You know, we made these huge loans to countries. That was part of my job. And backed them with what we call neoliberal economic policies. And that means that we make these demands of countries when they take our loans. We demand that they collateralize their resources, that they privatize many of their businesses, that they cut taxes on the rich. They cut taxes on the rich and they cut social services to everybody else. It creates a lot of resentment. The Chinese, on the other hand, are saying, we don't do that. And to a large degree, they don't. There's some exceptions. They're not as good as they sound, of course, either. You know, there's propaganda there, too. There's no question. But they haven't built the military bases. And they don't insist on these political issues that we often insist on, that countries keep certain people in power, people that support us. So this resentment has grown. And at the same time, China has an amazing story to tell. You know, it has brought more than 800 million people out of poverty, according to the World Bank. And no other country's ever done anything like that. That's more than the rest of the world combined.
Wow. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, 800 million people out of dire poverty. Now, these people aren't rich today. We might not even consider them middle class, but they're not. They've been brought out of dire poverty, and there's still so many around the world, in Africa and Latin America, and even in our own cities that are still in dire poverty. And they had, you know, averaged about 10% economic growth for 30 years. Nobody's done anything like that. And so if you're the leader of another country, you're saying, gee, you know, I think that's a better model than the U.S. one, which has nothing to compare and has treated us poorly, has made us build military bases on our soil, has exploited our resources and used neoliberal economics. So I think, you know, the Chinese economic hitmen learned from us not to do those things, at the same time to emphasize the incredible recent history that they have of economic success.
Did you say it was 800 million people out of poverty or lifted? What was that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
It was a little bit more than that, according to the president of the World Bank. And that's in my book. There's a reference
right.
in there. She's looking for a reference.
Well, you know, we've done the opposite. When FDR was president, he created a middle class in the United States, and 60% of the middle class, 60% of the population was in the middle class. And then when Reagan became president and put in a lot of the anti-union, austerity, pro-corporate methodologies, today only 45% of the American public is in the middle class. So we've gone the other direction.
That's absolutely right. And also, the real minimum wage in this country, when you account for inflation, hasn't increased since the early 70s. Think about that.
Yeah, I don't want to. No.
the real inflation.
It's really awful.
It's terrible. But and China makes that point very strongly when it's in the process of trying to, its economic hitmen are making their offers to other countries. They point out both of those facts about the middle class and about the minimum wage in this country. So they have an incredible story to tell, Jill. And on top of that, they've got this thing they call the New Silk Road. they're building up systems around the world so they tell countries, well, let me back up. When I would do a deal with these countries, let's say Ecuador, where I spend quite a lot of time, you know, we'd set up these deals with Ecuador. We'd have free trade agreements and so on, and make Ecuador a most favored nation, which meant that our bilateral trade with Ecuador was really improved. Ecuador had most favored nation and so forth to trade with us, but it was about us. China says, we don't do that. We're going to help Ecuador trade with everybody, with countries in Africa. We're going to help Ecuador build ports so they can trade with Africa and Asia and you know, the whole world. It's not about just trading with us. In addition, we're going to build roads to help Ecuador trade with Peru and Colombia and the other countries on the Latin American continent. And they're doing the same thing in Africa. So they have this whole amazing system, which is called the New Silk Road. Its official title is the Belt and Road Initiative. And it's brilliant. It truly is a brilliant concept. And again, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm promoting what China's doing. I'm not at all. China's made a lot of huge mistakes. They've had some terrible engineering fiascos in many of these countries, and they're out to do the same thing. They're creating a death economy like we are. But they have some very good stories to tell, and their economic hitmen have become very, very efficient.
Well, this is a good time to take a break. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. You're listening to Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I'm speaking with our bold guest, John Perkins, who's a former chief economist who advised the World Bank, the United Nations, Fortune 500 corporations, and governments around the world, and who is the author of 11 books. And see a video John has for you at johnperkins.org/economic-hitman-book. We will be back right after Jim Hightower's commentary titled, Checking the Price You Pay for Corporate Food.
Oftentimes, when you suspect you're being gouged by corporate price fixers, you are. Take the rat-a-tat-tat of today's price jumps at supermarkets and chain restaurants. They make you want to rush to the cash register before they raise prices again. No, no, cry the CEOs of food giants. It's not us. It's, quote, supply chain disruptions. Then corporate politicians and economists chime in with old platitudes about the invisible hand of supply and demand. And media know-nothings also pile on, blathering about ne'er-do-wells causing a labor shortage. But hogwash, your suspicions are right. It's plain old price-fixing by avaricious food monopolies. Top executives even brag about it when talking to their bankers and shareholders. McDonald's, for example, recently told investors that, quote, strategic menu price increases in the past 3 months had boosted profits by 63%. Big Mac CEO exulted, I'm really proud of how our system has executed pricing. Never mind that it's their customers being executed. Well, say free market proselytizers, just buy from a competitor. But in nearly all segments of today's food economy, a handful of giants control the market, with each one in on the fix. For example, Chipotle, a McDonald's rival, also jacked up prices in the same three-month period, manufacturing an 84% profit increase. Its CEO then gloated to Wall Streeters, I think we've demonstrated we do have pricing power. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, these same giants are also fattening their profits by ripping off their workers. The federal poverty level is now $25,000 a year, with fast food workers typically getting only $3,000 a year more than that bare minimum for a 40-hour week. But there's the gotcha. The profiteering executives hold each worker to about 26 hours a week, creating a sub-poverty labor force for this multi-billion dollar industry. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
We're back. My guest today is John Perkins, author of his third edition of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, before we move on, did you have any thoughts listening to that commentary that you wanted to share?
Well, I agree with an awful lot of it. These big corporations, and again, we talked earlier about free markets. Well, you know, these big chains drive the little guy out of business in many, many parts of the country. That's not a free market. That's not even true capitalism. That's what I call predatory capitalism, where the big guys, the bullies, come in and they either drive the competition out of business or buy them up, you know, or threaten to. They seem to be driving them out of business, and then they can buy them up for you know, pennies on the dollar, so to speak. So yeah, I agree. We've got what we call the corporatocracy, which is really a combination of big business and government working close together, and you get the same people often, you know, moving back and forth between government and big business.
Well, there's a new word that has come up lately, which is greedflation. And talking about the inflation that we're experiencing is not being propelled by an overheated economy. It's being propelled by overheated profits. Do you agree?
Yes, I think it's both. I think they're both in there. And when you get the economy starts to heat up, the businesses see the possibility then of increasing profits more and more and more. Interest rates go up, as we've seen happening, and this gives them another excuse to increase their prices. And, of course, it hurts everybody even more because people are paying higher interest rates on their credit cards and so many other things. And the prices are also increasing. So it's a very dangerous situation, and it's unfortunate that we have a system that permits that to expand. And the only reason it can is because so many of these big companies have driven the small guy out of business. Competition, real good, real true competition is extremely healthy from an economic standpoint.
Well, we don't have that anymore. Seems like we don't even enforce our monopoly regulations or laws anymore either. I just wanted to ask you, before we move on, you know, you also wrote about when you witnessed how officials were who attempted to stand up to the corporatocracy were threatened, tortured, or even killed. You think you might have even been poisoned yourself when you left this role and began exposing the economic hitman system. Tell us about that. It's kind of dramatic. Well, tell us about that.
Yeah, so go back a little bit to when I first quit being an economic hitman. I began to understand. At the beginning, I thought I was doing the right thing because this idea of investing billions of dollars in poor countries increases their GDP. That's taught in business schools. It's taught by the World Bank. And it does increase their GDP. And so I thought I was doing the right thing. But I began to understand as time went on that GDP is not a measure of overall prosperity. It's a measure of how well the rich are doing, big corporations, not the average citizen. And in fact, they can be getting worse off as the rich get better off, and it looks like GDP is doing well. Once I understood that, I got out. I quit, and that's another long story. But I wanted to write a book to expose the system. I started to contact other people who had jobs like mine and the jackals, and immediately I get phone calls threatening my life and that of my infant daughter, and. At the same time, I get taken out to dinner by the president of Stone & Webster Engineering Corporation, a big consulting firm in Boston, a major and you know, a competitor of mine, companies. And he said, you know, you've got a really good resume. Hey, you're a chief economist at one of our competitors. We'd like to use your resume in our proposals. You won't have to really do any work for us. Just let us use your resume. Mm-hmm. And I'm prepared to write you a check tomorrow morning for $500,000.
Wow.
And, well, I got to tell you, Jill, this is the late 80s. $500,000.
Was a lot.
Yes, it was. And he said, just don't write the book.
Oh, my.
And, yeah, so I was kind of getting the same treatment that I'd given the states of other countries. You know, here. Take the money, take the loan, help yourself, help your businesses progress and all that of all your friends, or the jackals will come in. And, you know, I took the money, I have to say. And in my own defense, I put it back. I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer in the Amazon. I went back to the Amazon. I said, I want to help you guys save your rainforest. I formed a bunch of nonprofits. I wrote 5 books on indigenous people and the importance of saving the rainforest. And you know, the Stone Webster was fine with me doing that. But I didn't write the book about economic hitmen. You know, I didn't want my daughter to die. I didn't want to die myself.
Mm-hmm.
And but then after 9/11, during 9/11, I was deep in the Amazon. I was taking groups in to help understand about environmentalism. And when I came home, I flew to Ground Zero. And as I stood there, I knew I had to write a book about what I'd done. And I decided my contract with Stone & Webster was up. I decided that this time I wouldn't tell anybody I was writing the book. I now had 5 books published on indigenous people. I knew you were supposed to submit a proposal. I didn't do that. I decided I would do this completely in secret. I wouldn't contact anyone else. I would write a personal confession. And I wrote the whole book and figured I got it in the hands of my very good literary agent in New York, and he starts distributing it to publishers, and I figure it's my insurance policy. And eventually, you know, one of the publishers published it, and about 3 or 4 months after it was published, I was asked to speak at the United Nations in New York. But that night, I lost a huge amount of blood in my body, was rushed to New York City Hospital, and in the end had 70% of my large intestine removed.
Oh, my.
Now, between the time I arrived at LaGuardia Airport around noon and the time that I lost blood in my body, I'd been taken out to lunch by this so-called journalist who had strange credentials, but my publicist arranged for me to have lunch with him. During lunch, after the food had been served, I recall going to the restroom, and I was really unimpressed with this journalist. Like, he asked some very, just stupid questions. And after this happened to me, we began receiving messages saying, "Don't you know that John was poisoned?" And at the time, I hadn't thought about it. I was just thinking about surviving. I was in agony when I was rushed to the hospital, and the doctors took out 70% of my colon. And now my publicist cannot get in touch with this guy again. All she had was an email for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was no longer responding to emails. He disappeared. And I talked to my the doctor who the gastroenterologist who who'd served me in New York, and I said, "Do you think it was poison?" And he said, "Well, it's possible, but we can't say because we destroyed the evidence. We knew what we're but the protocol is as soon as we remove something like that from your body, we incinerate it. So there's no way of telling." But the fact that then this guy disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
We had no more information on him. He obviously was using a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, there was no evidence, so there's no point in going after him. But yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, it sure sounds like it. I mean, deduction. It's very suspicious.
And I should mention just about 3 or 4 months before that, I had a colonoscopy and been given pretty much a clean bill of health. So there's no reason to have thought that there was something wrong with my colon.
Well, the speed that things happened and how fast you land in the hospital is also suspicious. So he wasn't an economic hitman. He was just a hitman.
Well, I've checked with some friends of mine who were jackals. I had friends that were in the business of being jackals. I was in that. I knew these people. I checked with them, and especially one of them, and he said, I don't think this guy was one of the alphabets agencies, FBI, CIA, NSA.
Because
mm-hmm. he'd been part of that, you wouldn't be talking to me now. Plus, they don't really. They wouldn't want to see you die of some mysterious, strange thing because that sells books. And, of course, it did. That experience I had did sell a lot of books. People So he said, they wouldn't want to do that. And I said, "Well, who do you think did it?" And he said, I imagine it was a fanatic, someone who either hated what you'd done or hated the fact that you exposed what you'd done. And I said, "Well, do you think you'll come after me again?" And I was told, "No. Probably not. These people usually are fairly cowardly. He knows you'd recognize him. He's not likely to do it again. He probably figures he's already done his job. He scared you. He put the fear of God in you, and so the chances are he won't come after you again. And knock on wood, he hasn't, or nobody has."
Well, you've lived an exciting life. I tell you, most of us haven't gone through something like that. If you are just joining us, my bold interview guest is John Perkins, author of 11 books, and we're discussing his third edition of his New York Times bestseller, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and find out more at johnperkins.org, Economic Hitman book. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Tune in this evening at 6 p.m. here at KSQD for State of Mind, hosted by Santa Cruz licensed psychotherapist Deborah Sloss. People have moved their bodies through dance for thousands of years. Movement and dance offer many benefits for mental health and brain function. Joining Deborah for a conversation about the therapeutic benefits of movement are Dr. Rachel Jordana Horodesky, a licensed psychotherapist, yoga instructor, and dance instructor, entrepreneur and dancer Shankar Hemedy, and arts administrator and lifelong dancer Valeria Miranda. That's State of Mind this evening at 6 here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org.
We're back, and I don't want to go on any further, John, without asking you how economic hitmans have been fighting against the climate crisis and how their assault on people and the earth results in what you call a fatal competition. Tell us more about that.
Well, so the whole premise of our current economic system is to maximize short-term profits for corporations and maximize materialistic consumption for the rest of us. I was about 3 weeks ago now, I was lecturing at a college in Southern California. And at the end of the lecture, I said, any questions? You know, did anybody have questions? And somebody raised his hand. He seemed to be older than the students. And it turned out he was an economics professor. And he said to me, you know, I never heard all this before about the life economy. And he said, yeah, I realized that my job is to teach people to be successful in the death economy. And that's true. What we do in our schools is bring people up to be part of this system and join big corporations and become basically cogs in the system of a death economy. And it is an economic system that's depleting the resources it depends upon. It's depleting them in the short run, depends on them in the long run, consuming and polluting itself into extinction. We really must move beyond that because it is destroying life on this planet as we know it. Climate change is a direct result of that, as is environmental destruction. So we move into a life economy that pays people to turn things around, to clean up pollution and regenerate destroyed environments and recycle, et cetera, as I talked about earlier.
Just as a side note, when you were talking about the students had never heard of the death economy or life economy, and I'm starting to ask questions of my guests on how you're reaching the scrolling readers. You know, there are a lot of people. I've sort of done an unofficial survey when I meet people, and I ask, are they a reader? And they'll go, no, and I get my information on the social media. And I'm finding that more and more people are just scrolling to find their news. And we can reach younger people and non-readers that way. And I'm hoping your publisher or someone will take your book and put the bites in, you know, the little bits in for the scrolling readers, you know, Pinterest and Instagram and different places. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I am on Instagram and Facebook and
good.
Twitter.
Good.
I've done even some TikTok presentations. But, you know, yeah, it's even worse than what you were describing, Jill, and that you know, if you seem to be leaning toward liberalism or if you seem to be leaning toward conservatism or whatever, that's what you hit with because these algorithms understand that. So, yeah, it's a very difficult situation and a dangerous one. And I think what we need to recognize today is that all of us need to come together to create this life economy. You know, we have, every one of your listeners is a consumer, and they have power at the marketplace. And many of them are employees of corporations. Some of them are managers, I suspect. And so we need to use the leverage that we each have. It's important that we shop consciously, but it's also important that we let companies know why we're shopping consciously. We tell those that we don't buy from because they're not moving toward a life economy. We tell them, I'm not buying from you for that reason. And it's so easy to do with social media. I often
and refer to an executive with a big company who recently told me, you know, I want my company to be greener. I have children and grandchildren. But I know that if I lose market share or my stock price goes down, I'll be fired and replaced by someone who only cares about market share or stock prices. And so I'd ask you, John, to tell everybody what I'm telling you right now, Joe, I'm telling your listeners, write me a letter. So pick, if every one of your listeners would pick a corporation that they want to see change, and write a short, you know, piece that they can put on social media and say something that's positive, like, hey, I love your product, but I'm not going to buy it anymore until you pay your workers in Indonesia a fair wage, or stop polluting the river that your factories are on, or whatever the issue is with that company. And once you do that, I and many of my followers will see to it that people around the world know that you're a leader in this business, and you're, and in the long run, your profits will go up. Everything will work to your advantage. And, you know, I suggest to people to start a consumer campaign that way. You write that email or tweet or whatever it is, and then you make sure that all your social networking people hear from you, and you ask them to do the same thing. And these executives will tell me that, you know, when I don't read all these emails, but somebody does, and I get a summary periodically. And when I get that kind of a summary that 100,000 of our clients, our customers, have been demanding that we do this or that, I can take that to my primary investors and tell them, look, we've got to listen to our customers. It's a powerful tool, and we all have that available to us. And, you know, and I tell people in China the same thing. So it really doesn't, you know, the problem today to a large degree is that both China and the United States are using this economic hitman system to create a death economy, and we both need to turn it around. These two countries control or create almost half of the world's economy and almost the same amount of the pollution in the world. Two countries. Trade almost half. And so these two countries need to be convinced that they need to, that they and their corporations have to move us into a life economy, or in the long run the companies themselves won't prosper.
Well, you've naturally gone into my keep, stop, start section in the last quarter. I like to ask what we can do, what we can keep doing, stop doing, start doing, and you've talked about that beautifully, and you have in your book a generic form letter people can use if they don't know how to draft something like that. And you're also making me feel a little bit better. My position has been if corporations were people, because they're not, that was based on a head note that a law clerk wrote, a conservative law clerk wrote, that's never been a decision by the Supreme Court. It's never been legislation out of Congress, just a head note. And somehow corporations became people. And I've always said if a corporation was a person, they'd be a psychopath because as a corporation, they can't show, they have no humility, compassion, or empathy, which are human traits. But if we do write what you're saying, you're suggesting that these letters to corporations, what we like about them, but what we want them to change, maybe we could be that, the compassion and empathy, and force that on corporations. Do you have any additional items under the keep, stop, start that you wanted to share? We've got about 30 seconds left, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that corporate executives are people, and some of them are sociopaths. Most of them aren't, but even the sociopaths, they don't want to just maximize profits. They want to do what will bring them the greatest fame, the greatest recognition. And so if we make our heroes out to be those people who are moving us toward a life economy, the psychopaths will come along too. So I would just say to all your listeners, that feel that we're living at a blessed time when we have the opportunity to create something human beings have never done before, and that is this global life economy. So participate. Get involved. Enjoy it. You know, it's fun to do these things. It's easy. Yeah, you said I have a model in the book, yes, and that only takes about
10 minutes to write, start distributing to all of your social networking circles, and it's, this is a great time to be alive and to realize that we really have the opportunity to create something that human beings have never created before.
Well, that is very exciting, and we must participate. Our future depends on it. Our future depends on it. So, John, thank you for being our bold and impressive guest today. I am so grateful for your time. It was such an honor. I was very excited when I learned I'd have a few minutes with you on air. So thank you for joining us on Be Bold America.
You're welcome, Jill. It's my pleasure, and I so appreciate what you do. Keep up your great work of bringing to light the boldness that we're experiencing and can continue to experience.
Thank you. And I love your cat. I'm a cat lover.
All right. I keep walking away from her and she follows me. She knows it's dinner time.
Yes, she's ready to eat. Okay. Yes. Thank you so much, John. So appreciate you and what you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate what you're doing too, Jill. Thank you.
Thank you.
What's next on Be Bold America? Please join us on Sunday, June 18th, Father's Day, when KSQD's Talk of the Bay host, Christine Barrington, brings you her behind-the-mic interview with Jill Cody, author of America Abandoned and Climate Abandoned, whose vision for an American political renaissance centers on igniting citizen action. Every other Sunday, Jill hosts local and national thought leaders who offer knowledge, insight, and strategic choices for recreating democracy. Join Christine Barrington to discover what inspired Jill to become a bold and dedicated voice for empowering political structures that work for all of life. Don't miss Christine Barrington's Behind the Mic interview with Jill Cody and join Be Bold America on Sunday, June 18th at 5 p.m.
As a reminder, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you may listen to the show anytime for free by subscribing through your favorite podcast platforms such as Apple, Google, and Spotify. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Eliza James, and to our station's program director, Howard Feldstein. You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for State of Mind with Deborah Schloss. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.